From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the May 2017 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Highs and Lows. Turn the clock back 75 years and we're about halfway through the war. The key thing to remember is they didn't know that then. We know how it turned out, but it was by no means a foregone conclusion. Remember, at the beginning, a stock phrase did the rounds, "It'll be over by Christmas." And that carried dark echoes of similar predictions early on in the long and bitter Great War of 1914-18. From this distance, it's an opportunity to take stock, looking at the highs and lows so far of the Government Code and Cipher School's top secret operation. We'll do that with Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon. But first, Helen Ledbetter was a wireless telegrapher in Canada during World War II, providing the codebreakers at Bletchley Park with the raw material they deciphered and turned into vital intelligence. She told her story to the broadcaster CBC, who we have to thank for letting us share it with you.
After 72 years of secrecy, a Cambridge woman finally has permission to tell her war story. Helen Ledbetter was a wireless telegrapher during the Second World War. Her job was to intercept messages sent to German submarines. That work was considered confidential until a few months ago. Ledbetter sat down with reporter Melanie Ferrier on Sunday, and she began her story at the Guild of All Arts in Toronto, where she received her training.
They had wired up several long tables, three to be exact, and you put your headphones into this jack underneath, and then the petty officer at the end would start sending you Morse code, and through repetition, you finally got it. But slowly, the chief petty officer, he would draw bits and pieces of maps on a portable chalkboard, and he would show us where there were shore stations. We didn't really know at that point that these were not owned by the Allies.
And when was it, like, describe the day where you finally were like, oh, that's what I'm doing.
Well, we knew when we were in the Guild of All Arts, but we didn't have any equipment to really deal with other than a pair of headphones. When it really happened, it was when we were all picked up from there, taken to a place called Number One Station. And the first time we went into the watch room, we sat down. The petty officer in charge, she kept on looking at the clock and she said, "You've got your frequencies. Now you're going to start searching and you're looking for the enemy. The clock is at 12 noon. You are on operations." And we started just like that. And we started looking for submarines that weren't ours. We knew where ours were. We didn't know where the other fellows were.
So, yeah, tell me more about, I guess, what it was you were doing.
You were wearing headphones, searching the dials on the frequencies you were given, hoping that sooner or later you'd trip over a submarine that wasn't ours. We would then sit there and copy it. And the petty officer would be there, and she'd be ready to grab it, run down the hall, because at the other end of the hall, there was our teletype unit. And she teletyped that through to officialdom. We surmised in Ottawa. You'll probably hear about this. They had an estate that was mid-London called Bletchley Park. And eventually everything landed in Bletchley Park because it was staffed with coders and decoders. Now, Bletchley Park was held up as a wonderful place. It was. But the one thing that got to me was, where does Bletchley Park get the material, we called it traffic, to work from? Oh, well, So eventually they had to say, you people are supplying it.
Now that it's over, like now that you've had a chance to think over it, how important was what you were doing?
It really was important, but we didn't think about that at the time. As soon as you finished your job, you left that room, you just automatically did not speak about it. We never spoke about it in the cabin. Our group, six of us, used to go out on hikes all the time. We never spoke about it when we were out hiking.
And it did it seem strange to you when you were having all that fun to not be talking about what you did during the other time?
No, you got quite used to that. As a matter of fact, when I was informed 3-4 months ago that we could talk about this now, you can't talk about it immediately. An explanation of what we did. It's difficult to stay there because there is where we couldn't go. It's easy to talk about a party we had, or I was thrown in, and it did happen, I was thrown into a bathtub, fully dressed in my dress uniform. I was going to a dance that night. Those are the things that we remember because they were fun. I mean, you don't talk about the endless hours that you sat with headphones on, going around a dial trying to find something that you never knew if it was there or not.
And did you ever think of, I guess, the enormity of what you were doing?
No, but I can give you an example of enormity. When we were in Scarborough, Yorkshire, that area was surrounded by bomber units. Quite a few of them were Canadians. Before it was daylight, when the sun was still down beyond the horizon, you'd hear the bombers taking off, and they would start to circle. And you looked up, all the vapor trails were pink. It was the most glorious sight you ever wanted to see. It was lovely. When they were all together, then they started going south. That's when it hit you. Within a matter of a couple of hours or less, these people will be bombing the continent. So you have a very beautiful sight who were headed for enemy territory and who were going to bomb anything and everything that got in their way. So this was beautiful. That wasn't. But it was part of what they call war.
That was Helen Ledbetter. She was speaking with reporter Melanie Ferrier. Helen Ledbetter served with the Women's Royal Canadian Naval Service during the Second World War. And for the past 72 years, her wartime work was considered classified. 3 months ago, she was finally given permission to share her story.
Museums at Night makes a welcome return this month on the 19th of May, this time exploring the night shift. As darkness falls, experience the hush of the huts, just as wartime workers would have done. On the first weekend of June, Bletchley Park will bring the 1940s back to life with a vintage weekend. Swing band The Bevan Boys will serenade you. There'll be a chance to get really glam at the pop-up salon and a chance for a browse at a vintage marketplace where there'll be beer, a barbecue and ice cream, among other treats. Speaking of barbecues, there's a treat just for dads on Father's Day, Sunday the 18th of June. As well as a welcome return by the Bevan Boys, MK Swing Band will be showing off their moves to inspire you to join in. And if your dad's not up for dancing, maybe he'll enjoy a beer tasting with Concrete Cow Brewery's special beer just for Bletchley Park, Station X. It's not just Station X beer that'll be flowing through the park this summer. There's a whole series of Pims in the Park events to celebrate MK50, that's the 50th anniversary of Milton Keynes, in case you were wondering. They start on the 23rd of July with a fabulous 50s afternoon, with the music of Frank Sinatra and barbecue treats for the whole family. This is the first of a series of uniquely themed events throughout the summer. So what are you waiting for? Book up for all these on the website now. There's a special symposium event about Bill Tutt, marking the opening of an exhibition all about him in the mansion. It's in just a few days' time, on Sunday the 14th of May, so grab the last few tickets while you can. for a day of talks and discussion about this little-known genius. This month's It Happened Here story is about highs and lows of the ever-so-complicated code-breaking operation at Bletchley Park during World War II. We have to remember that we know how it ended, but back then the country was in very real peril. The threat of invasion still hung in the air, and Hitler's forces were making great gains on fronts not only in Europe but North Africa too. Also, Singapore had surrendered in March 1942, and the Japanese advance still seemed unstoppable in the Far East. This is also around the time when the German Navy decided to tighten the security of its radio traffic in the Atlantic, where Allied shipping convoys were being found and sunk with horrifying success. There were a lot of lows, but it's not all doom and gloom. Let's explore this with Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Germany calling. Germany calling. We now present Lord Vauxhall speaking to England.
To say the British Empire is in danger today would be a very feeble understatement. Never before has it been in such a perilous position. Until Roosevelt and Churchill so needlessly provoked Japan into taking up arms, the greater part of the British Empire felt itself outside the war zone. Of course, to be outside the war zone is not necessarily to be safe. Even India is threatened. Canada is practically an American dominion, ruled by Roosevelt. The fate of Australia and New Zealand hangs in the balance. The Royal Air Force is too weak. The Royal Navy is too weak. And as yet, the common sense of the British people is too weak to perceive the catastrophic nature of the plight into which they have allowed Churchill to lead them.
David, is it fair to say that in spring 1942, it looked pretty bleak and like we were losing the war?
It did. There hadn't been many successes to shout about up to that point. And particularly in the spring of 42, there had been a series of setbacks and misfortunes over the winter that people were very worried about.
And by then, it will have felt already like it had been dragging on for a bit. These things go in phases, don't they? Nobody knew how long they were in for.
Absolutely. And I think as the third year of the war was starting, and there was an appreciation here at Bletchley as well as elsewhere that this wasn't necessarily going to finish anytime soon. And you get a different frame of mind almost, that the temporary make do and mend approach to things just won't work. And they really need to start organising for the long term in a much more structural way. And that's really noticeable here at Bletchley.
And going back another year to set the scene from 1941, Germany had been quite successful in Russia, hadn't they?
Well, they'd invaded the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941, and up to spring of 42, they were still doing pretty well. I mean, they'd had a setback not capturing Moscow before Christmas in 41, but by the spring of 42, they were regrouping and would push on, particularly in the south, towards the Caucasus. The German strategy, Hitler's kind of vision, if you like, was that if he went far enough into the southeast of Russia, he could get down through the Caucasus into Iran, effectively, and combine that with Rommel coming through Libya and Egypt. In hindsight, it looks like a far-fetched idea, but the idea was that they could link up right round the Mediterranean that way. And although Turkey was neutral at that point, there was always the potential that Turkey could join the war. And in the First War, they'd been on the side of the Germans. So things could go very pear-shaped in the Middle East very quickly.
Well, there's a catchphrase, if ever I heard one. It sounds like a far-fetched idea now, but the whole thing surely sounds, when you boil it down to what was it about, what was anybody trying to achieve, it's all a bit far-fetched, isn't it?
It probably doesn't feel like it at the time. The threats feel very real at the time.
Unter rücksichtslosem Einsatz von Menschen und Material wollten die nun eingeschlossenen drei Sowjetarmeen nach Osten ausbrechen. Gleichzeitig versuchten neu herangeführte bolschewistische Divisionen von Osten her den Kessel wieder zu öffnen. In erbitterten Abwehrkämpfen wurden alle diese verzweifelten Versuche abgeschlagen. Flakartillerie feuert auf sowjetische Panzer. Unsere Panzerkampfwagen treiben immer tiefere Keile in die bolschewistischen Divisionen. Sowjetische Panzer, die zu letzten verzweifelten Durchbruchsversuchen anrollen, werden in direktem Beschuss vernichtet.
There was a breakthrough at Stalingrad, but that was later in 1942. So this might have seemed like sort of the dark before the dawn in retrospect.
I think so. I mean, the winter of 42-43 and the Battle of Stalingrad is considered to be, by historians, the turning point on the Eastern Front. And in 1942, that hadn't happened yet. The Germans were still doing very well. So the end wouldn't have been in sight in the East by any means.
There's a term, wasn't there, for how they went about defeating areas with Kessel?
Kesselschlacht. Their technique was to try and encircle and capture Soviet forces rather than sort of assaulting them directly, if you like. And this technique had been very effective in 1941 and continued to be effective in 42. And it led to huge losses, personnel losses by the Russians, because hundreds of thousands of prisoners were being captured at any one time. One of the things the Russians did was to try and move a lot of their industry that had formerly been in European Russia out to sites beyond the Urals where they hoped it would be safe from the Germans. And they were taking factories apart and loading them onto railway wagons and moving them. And it was an incredible feat of sort of economics and engineering, but at this point, it really still hadn't got going. Latterly in the war, they were to produce huge amounts of military equipment from these relocated factories. But in 42, they were still really desperate for equipment. And the added burden came on Britain that we had to supply the Russians. And tanks, aircraft, all kinds of military equipment were being sent by convoy round to the Arctic ports of Russia to keep them in the war.
Marschall Rommel überreicht dem Panzergrenadier Günther Halm das Ritterkreuz zum Eisernen Kreuz.
Ich habe die Freude, Ihnen im Namen des Führers diese hohe Auszeichnung auszuhändigen.
Günther Halm ist erst 19 Jahre alt. Als Richtschütze einer Pack schoss er unter schwierigsten Bedingungen 7 Britenpanzer ab.
Ich gratuliere Sie zu dieser Auszeichnung und hoffe, dass Sie sie gesund nach Hause bringen. Wer so ein Kerl ist, der wird immer so ein Kerl sein, bei jeder Gelegenheit. Das erwarte ich natürlich von Ihnen.
Things weren't going all that well in North Africa either, were they?
No. The autumn of 41 had been very successful from a British perspective in North Africa. Tobruk had been relieved, and Operation Crusader, they'd managed to push right round past Benghazi and deep into Libya. Unfortunately, in the spring of 1942, that ground started to be lost again. The Germans counterattacked in January, liberated or recaptured Benghazi, liberated from their point of view, and the British were back several hundred miles by the spring. And indeed, in the course of May 1942, the Germans would launch a big offensive. Rommel struck back heavily around the Battle of Gazala, and that led to the Allied armies falling back deep into Egypt and almost to Alexandria and Cairo. There was a real feeling in the summer of 42 that Cairo might fall at any point.
It must have been a scary place to be then with all that action going on around you and all the changes, and it keeps shifting and moving back and forth. Was there an outpost in Cairo of the Government Code and Cipher School?
Yes, there was a GCNCS office that called itself Combined Bureau Middle East that was actually in the former Zoological Museum in Heliopolis. And I think we discussed this before once, but you have to imagine code breakers and stuffed crocodiles all in the same building. But they would have been very concerned that they were about to be overrun. But certainly by July, there's a day that was colloquially known as Ash Wednesday because they were so worried that the city would fall that all the government departments were burning secret documents in great bonfires. Fortunately, that didn't happen, but it shows the climate of fear that existed at that point.
My fellow Americans, It is nearly 5 months since we were attacked at Pearl Harbor. For the 2 years prior to that attack, this country had been gearing itself up to a high level of production of munitions. And yet our war efforts had done little to dislocate the normal lives of most of us. Since then, we have dispatched strong forces of our Army and Navy, several hundred thousand of them, to bases and battlefronts thousands of miles from home. We have stepped up our war production on a scale that is testing our industrial power, our engineering genius, and our economic structure to the utmost. We have had no illusions about the fact that this is a tough job and a long one. American warships are now in combat in the North and South Atlantic, in the Arctic, in the Mediterranean, in the Indian Ocean, and in the North and South Pacific. American troops have taken stations in South America, Greenland, Iceland, the British Isles, the Near East, the Middle East, and the Far East, the continent of Australia, and many islands of the Pacific. American war planes, manned by Americans, are flying in actual combat over all the continents and all the oceans. On the European front, the most important development of the past year has been, without question, the crushing counteroffensive on the part of the great armies of Russia against the powerful German army. These Russian forces have destroyed and are destroying more armed power of our enemies, troops, planes, tanks, and guns, than all the other United Nations put together.
There was peril on the sea as well. This is around the time when the German Navy decided it needed to tighten security with its Enigma network. Now that's when they added a fourth rotor and just blew the statistical likelihood of breaking into the traffic out of the water, if you like, to use a bit of a pun. It became much more difficult, didn't it?
Yes, the German Navy introduced the M4, the four-rotor Enigma machine, for their U-boats. The rest of the Navy carried on with the old three-rotor machine, but it made breaking U-boat communications hugely more difficult.
So to take it back to why they decided to do that, somebody must have been suspicious that we were reading their traffic to feel the need to step it up and roll out tighter security.
The Germans were concerned throughout the war that there were security risks with their machines. And Dönitz in particular, who was the commander of the U-boats, was worried, not that it was being intercepted and broken the way we were doing it, but rather that the code books might be being stolen or traitors might be giving away information. He saw it more as a sort of land-based threat to his headquarters security rather than a fault with the machine, if you like. But he was nonetheless concerned. And so on 1st of February 1942, they introduce the network that we refer to as Shark here at Bletchley Park, which is a four-rotor U-boat network. And that makes it vastly more difficult to break U-boat traffic.
Was it 10 months before they broke in again?
Yes, it's not until they capture some of the relevant code books from U-559 in October that they get back into it. The other problem you have during that period is that the Americans have been in the war for a few months, but they haven't really got their heads around how to protect against U-boats. And a lot of American merchant traffic is still sailing up the east coast of the US. And they don't have a blackout. They're not expecting to be bombed or anything. But the problem with this is that ships sailing up the coast are silhouetted against the lights of the coast. And they weren't in convoy either. So the Germans simply sent U-boats over to lurk off the coast of the US.
And there are big cities right on the coast as well,
yeah.
So it's a lot of light.
A lot of light. And they sank hundreds of ships. It's what the Germans refer to as the second happy time, where the U-boats were being particularly successful against Allied shipping. I mean, the Americans get their heads around what's going on eventually, but it's that period again when the war in the Atlantic looks to be going really badly.
War wieder läuft. Der Kommandant hat das Doppelglas in den Augen. Tick, tick, tick. Langsam schleichen die schwarzen Zeiger auf das Doppel. Der Torpedo-Offizier steht angespannt hinter dem Zielgeber. Alles starke Mühe. Man hält den Atem.
Bei Lage 95. Schlafen!
So here at Bletchley Park, they must have felt the pressure of that blackout quite keenly, knowing how many lives, and not just lives on those ships, but what those ships were carrying being so important to people's survival here and the war effort itself. There was almost like a triple lock of doom every time a convoy ship was sunk. So the pressure on these people here, what do we know about what the mood was like at that time?
Well, here at Bletchley Park, it's kind of a low point for Bletchley as well. There had been a number of complaints about the way things were being done. The famous letter from Turing and the others to Churchill went in September 41, but the fruits of that were only starting to come through. Also, Hut 3, there'd been a major sort of breakdown of management in Hut 3, and eventually the senior members of the Hut in spring 1942 had all to be sacked or moved.
Hut 3, just for anyone who doesn't know, is where the material was sort of turned into intelligence. Was it translated there? Or was
Army and Air Force intelligence was translated and turned into ultra messages, essentially.
So at that point, you've got to finesse the information and repackage it, and there's kind of quite a lot of delicacy in disguising its source and so on.
Very much so. And one of the unsung heroes, I think, of Bletchley is the man who takes charge, which is Eric Jones. He didn't have any languages, he didn't speak German, he'd never done any code breaking, he wasn't a mathematician. He'd come from the cloth trade in the Midlands. But what he was an excellent manager of people, and he was put in charge of the Hut. By his own admission, he said, "I don't understand what you do, but I can, you know, make sure you do it well." And he actually went on to be head of GCHQ after the war. It shows that you didn't need to be a mathematical genius to work here.
Well, being good at the doing of a job doesn't make you good at the managing of other people doing that job necessarily. So, yeah, management
Absolutely.
Is a skill in itself.
And it's the same period when Denniston moves back to London to run the diplomatic section and Travis takes over here at Bletchley Park. And around that, I think, like I was saying earlier, this idea of gearing up for the long haul and establishing a more permanent and organised footing for everything. This building that we're sitting in, Block A, opened in the spring of 1942, and Naval Section moved in here from Hut 4. They would have been in the middle of that U-boat blackout at the time, so there'd have been a lot of very frustrated people in this building. But it was the first of many, A to H, the blocks that were built. And that reflects this serious long-term investment that the organisation was making, realising that the war wasn't going to finish anytime soon and they really had to get their heads down and crack on.
And, of course, there's no such thing as a eureka moment where one day everything was bleak and difficult and the next day everything was going really well. It was a slow turning of the tide, wasn't it, and a sort of rising to the surface with that U559, the capture of those code books and the incredible bravery of the young men that went and got them off the U-boat.
Dawn, 30th of October, 1942. A periscope and the outline of a submarine are spotted by a Royal Air Force patrol aircraft in the eastern Mediterranean. This sighting will be a vital turning point at Bletchley Park. HMS Batard and three other warships are on the scene by 10 a.m. and spend the next 10 hours hunting and depth charging the U-boat. Night has fallen when the submarine is finally forced to surface after sustaining serious damage. Chaotic scenes unfold as the enemy crew start to abandon ship. Knowing the U-boat could contain vital intelligence which could be utilized by the Allies, Tanny Fasson, the first lieutenant on Petard, and able seaman Colin Grazier immediately leap into the sea and swim through a mass of fleeing U-boat men towards the U-559. They are followed by Naffy canteen assistant Tommy Brown. Cold and wet, Fasson and Grazier board the submarine, climbing down the conning tower into the blackness below. Whilst the U-boat is gradually filling with water, the two men hand various Enigma treasures to Brown, who, after exploring the engine and control room, has positioned himself on the U-boat's conning tower. "Abandon ship!" Brown screams, and plunges into the dark waters to be rescued by the boat crew. At that moment, the ill-fated U-boat suddenly takes in an enormous amount of water and rapidly sinks, taking Tony Fasson and Colin Grazier with it. The bodies of Fasson and Grazier were never recovered. Almost certainly they drowned, trapped in the sinking submarine.
And they perhaps didn't even know that story here when they got the code books in their hands. It wouldn't have mattered, really, would it, at that point to them? It was just about what they could do.
October 1942 is an interesting time because a number of successes happen around the same time, slightly coincidentally. You get, on the naval side, they break back into Shark. They start reading U-boat communications. In North Africa, of course, you have El Alamein and the turning of the tide there. After that, the Germans are only ever in retreat. The battle in Stalingrad starts around that time as well. And so that late 42 period is generally regarded as a major turning point on all sorts of different fronts. In May, a lot of things were still very much in doubt.
Sa habag-habag ang nangyari sa Nichols Airfield pagkatapos na mabomba ng mga aeroplanong Hapones, ang lahat ng aeroplanong Amerikano ay nawasak at ang mga kamalig ay nasilap. Ang mga bombang hinihulog ng aeroplanong Hapones sa estasyon ng radyo sa Maynila. Ang lahat ng balita dito ay pawang kasinungalingan. Ngayon, ang tunay na mga balita ay masasagap ninyo sa estasyon ng KCRH Maynila.
We've talked quite a lot about what the Germans were up to and how we were and weren't dealing with that and how well. What was Japan up to at this point?
Well, from the viewpoint of May 1942, the war in the Far East had been going for nearly 6 months, with Pearl Harbor in December 1941 and the invasion of Malaya, of course. And it had been all one way, really, up to this point. The Japanese had been extremely successful. Singapore surrendered in March 1942, which is an enormous blow for British imperial prestige and would have, you know, put the fear of God into a lot of people. If they could capture Singapore, what couldn't they do? Actually, Singapore was very poorly defended, but that wasn't how it was perceived at the time. And the Americans were in retreat from the Japanese as well. So things were not looking good on that front. And from a direct GCNCS point of view, the Far East Combined Bureau, which was the branch of GCNCS that had been set up to monitor the Japanese, had started out in Singapore, and they'd managed to evacuate from Singapore and had moved to Colombo in Sri Lanka. Colombo was attacked in turn by the Japanese on Easter weekend, 1942.
They had to up sticks and move again.
They up sticks and moved again, yes, to Mombasa in Kenya, to Kilindini. The unfortunate thing about Mombasa was it was actually so far away from Japanese operations they couldn't really hear much radio traffic. So trying to intercept Japanese radio and figure out what they were doing was very difficult. That you're not in range of was very difficult. I mean, they were collaborating with the Americans and sharing text and information and things with each other. But there was a real fear that Sri Lanka was going to be invaded, you know, mainland India was potentially going to be invaded. And so, again, very much on the back foot. Little did they know, I mean, it wasn't until later in 1942, Battle of Midway, the Japanese sort of expansion ambitions reached their high tide, probably at Midway, and their fleet takes a massive loss in that battle, which means that further expansion operations were very difficult. But that was still in the future at this point.
Hardly had the din of guns been hushed in the Coral Sea when the Battle of Midway blazed forth in all its mighty fury. Here the United States forces met and crushed a full Jap battle fleet. By sheer weight of numbers, the Japs hoped to overwhelm and conquer our mid-Pacific fighting forces. The Japs had carefully planned this sneak attack. They gambled all and lost. The Battle of Midway, the Japs hoped, would be their stepping stone to Pearl Harbor, Australia, Alaska, and eventually, the United States mainland. Here the Japs received a mortal wound. Here our defenders were ready. First in the air were our Marine Corps fighters, then our Army flyers, and finally, our fighting Navy, all working in complete unity and concentrating relentlessly and successfully upon the common enemy. The toll of enemy fighting power was decisive. 3 Japanese battleships, possibly 4 cruisers, 3 transports, and 1 destroyer were sunk. The loss of the Jap aircraft carriers was extremely heavy. 2 or 3 sunk and 2 badly damaged. As the Jap fleet turned about, battered and beaten, the Battle of Midway became America's outstanding success, and one that may decisively change the balance of striking power in the Western Ocean. In the face of terrific anti-aircraft fire, Jap planes swooped close, their suicide pilots knowing full well that their battle is ended. Although never within a day's sailing distance of each other, the battle carried on furiously for 5 full days. Aircraft action was paramount. The perfect teamwork at Midway between the commanders of our Army, Navy, and Marines struck the Japs a truly crippling and now historic blow. To the Navy goes America's profound thanks and admiration. To its individual heroes go decorations, symbolic of the highest honors a nation can bestow upon its fearless fighting men. And to the Marines and our Army men goes a nation's heartfelt gratitude. United as one great force, they will repeat the triumphs of Coral Sea and Midway in the mighty battle still ahead. A battle that will go on.
There seems to be hardly a territory in the world that it didn't affect somehow.
Certainly by the spring of 42, the war is going on, it feels like it's going on everywhere. And you only need to look at the front pages of the papers from that period to see, you know, there'll be 4 or 5 stories on every front page, and they're scattered all over the world. You'll hear about what's happening on the Russian front, what's happening in the Atlantic, what's happening in North Africa, what's happening out in the Far East. And an example of the reach of the war at that point is that the Japanese also have designs on Australia, and Darwin in North Australia got bombed by the Japanese in the spring of 1942. So it must have felt like the Axis powers had a reach to almost anywhere. And it just must have seemed like it was doom and gloom from all corners.
First pictures from Darwin show that the northern outpost of the Aussies has taken quite a beating from Jap bombs. But despite everything, they're carrying on with that fighting spirit that typifies everyone in Australia.
This is London, 5 o'clock in the morning. People do a great deal of walking in London these days, but much of mine is done at night. Moonlit nights are best. There's less danger of walking into lampposts or stumbling over the curb. The weather stains on old buildings of gray Portland stone look like familiar, friendly faces. The city is absolutely quiet, like a ghost town in Nevada. At dawn, that'll be about an hour from now, the mist goes floating upward from the water in Regent's Park, and the feet of the milkman's horse sound soft and muffled on the old wooden paving blocks. Occasionally, the cart will lurch, and the milk bottles rattle as one wheel drops into a hole burnt by one of last winter's incendiary bombs. But it's pleasant walking in London, even when the night is black. The street lights give off just a tiny pinpoint of light, enough so you can steer a course between them right down the middle of the street. The nice part about walking in the dark is, of course, that you can't see anything. There's nothing to distract you. You just plod along between those little beacons. It's like being up in the bow of a ship at sea on a dark night. Occasionally you hear footsteps, and sometimes you may exchange a good evening with another unseen pedestrian. Sometimes you can imagine, or at least think you can, just what people are like from the sounds made by their feet. There'll be a young officer on leave and his girl walking home at 2 in the morning. There'll be the uneven cadence from the feet of a man who's had one too many drinks. The reluctant footsteps of a bus conductor on his way to work. You can't see them, but you know who they are, or think you do. For example, just a block from this studio, there's a policeman. I've never seen him, but he's there when I walk home every night. Sometimes we speak, sometimes we don't. Last night, I heard him shift his weight from one foot to the other as I walked past. Sometimes he's traveling in my direction, and we cruise along for a block or two together. He has big feet, and his shoes squeak. I think I'd recognize that squeak in Cairo or Chicago. Without ever having seen him, I know he's a big, friendly, stable sort of person. The kind of London cop who can disperse a crowd by merely saying, "Here, here, move along now." I know, too, that he likes the dark, likes being out there all alone. He never seems to be about on bright, moonlit nights. Some night, maybe I'll see him in the bright moonlight and discover that he's a short, sour-faced reserve policeman in an ill-fitting uniform. But I don't think so.
Now, we did say it's not all doom and gloom, looking at sort of this midpoint of 1942. Let's look at a brighter note of perhaps the beginnings of a huge breakthrough here at Bletchley Park. A chap called Bill Tutt was beavering away here, making quite good headway on what had been termed a new music they were hearing on the airwaves.
Yes, Bletchley Park had been intercepting a different German signal. This wasn't the Morse code that we're all familiar with. This was it's been described to me as a two-tone warble. It was actually two signals which alternated between them. And it had been identified that this was teleprinter traffic. The idea being that you had a teleprinter plugged into a radio transmitter and it sent text over the link. As you typed it. Or you could type a teleprinter tape and then feed it into a transmitter and it would send it all in one go.
So that's quite a lot more efficient in terms of time and manpower, where you've got three people operating an Enigma machine.
Yeah.
This was somebody sitting typing a message straight into something.
Yes, it's much more efficient.
Information.
And the messages were longer and more significant in many cases. The problem they had in this country was initially this signal was being intercepted and then they had to figure out what it was and what to do with it. And by the middle of 1941, they'd identified that it was an encrypted teleprinter message.
Now, I can imagine arguments going on about how important it was and how much effort we should be putting into trying to deal with this. They've got this huge other operation that's already, you know, running on rails by this time and taking up all the perhaps time, manpower and funding they have. So imagine the discussions that must have gone on. Someone saying, no, we really need to pay attention to this. How do you think that went?
Well, in the summer of 1941, they set up a research department, it was called, in the back of the mansion under John Tiltman and Jerry Morgan. They sat in the back of the mansion and they were given a long list of all the currently unsolved problems, if you like, and told, well, have a go at these and see how you get on. And one of those was this non-Morse teleprinter traffic. And Tiltman had made a massive break into it by spotting two messages that were transmitted in August 41 that were very, very similar. And he was able to extract the code string from the encrypted message. So he had a whole series of letters which were used to encrypt the message. But the question was, how did the Germans come up with that string of letters? And that was given to Bill Tutt, who at the time was 24 years old. He'd just left Cambridge University back in January. He'd been on a GCNCS training course and then arrived in Bletchley Park in the May of that year. And it wasn't until the autumn that he was confronted with this mysterious new code. Fortunately for Bletchley and for the war effort, he was quite quickly able to identify how it was put together, and more importantly, how the machine that created it, that what we now know as the Lorentz cipher machine, how that machine was put together. And once he'd kind of figured out part of it, the rest of the team jumped on the back of his efforts, and it was by the spring of 1942 that they had how the machine functioned completely figured out.
That's incredible. The reverse engineering, if you like, working out from this string of letters what it was, how it had come about and how this thing worked. Unbelievable.
It is, but it doesn't come completely out of the blue in the sense that the German machine used bits and pieces and techniques from a variety of other machines that GCNCS would have been familiar with.
Yeah.
So it was up to Tutt to look at how other ciphers were constructed, fall back on his training a little bit. I mean, he admitted himself that he used techniques that he was taught on his training course. But also a little bit of inspired imagination to go, well, if you combined that with that, how would that work, sort of thing. And he was able to come up with a solution for the machine. I mean, that's only the beginning of the problem, because understanding how the machine works still doesn't break you the code. But later in 1942, he was able to come up with what's called his statistical method, which was the way of actually breaking the code as well. And from that point on, there's an appreciation of just how important to the Germans Lorentz communication was, because it was used for up to 10,000 character long, important, high level communications between sort of Hitler and his field marshals. So it was a window on really high level knowledge of what the Germans were up to, strategic thinking.
Yeah.
It was still extraordinarily difficult, and they still broke only a tiny fraction of the traffic was sent, but every message they got was real gold dust.
You worked with Built Up in the testery. How do you remember him?
We were like two Red Indians from different tribes. We spoke different languages, but we were quite friendly. He was a mathematician. I was a linguist. He hadn't the slightest interest in the German language, and I was out of my depth with mathematics. So we exchanged the time of day, but not much more, because his nature was very different from mine. A rather slow-moving man, spoke fairly slowly. I have a mental image of him, staring into the middle distance, and twiddling his pencil, making counts on reams of paper. And I used to wonder whether he was getting anything done. My goodness, he was. He was breaking Tunney. Once he had done that, he had broken the system. We knew how the system worked. Tut broke Tunney in spring 42, and the test room moved on to it July 1st. We were doing something else. We were all switched over to Tunney as of the 1st of July 42. The Tunney system encrypted the text not once, not twice, but three times. I would think it is almost unique that anybody has broken something with three levels of encryption.
So you were decrypting and reading messages that were sent by the absolute top brass, Hitler himself, and the very few at the highest level.
The messages most often were signed at one end by one of four people, four field marshals: Keitel, who was the head of the whole army; von Jodl, who was the chief of staff of the army, the top operating officer; and his number two, Varlamont. And then, of course, the fourth was Hitler himself. That started in early 1944. And I remember today the excitement when we broke the first message with his signature on. And indeed, when I broke my first message signed by him, it really was special.
How long did it generally take to get into the day's settings?
Yeah, good question. In Fahrenheit, typically, you would expect to break it within a shift, which was 8 hours. Sometimes it would be tough and difficult. In that case, very often people stayed on until they'd broken it because they couldn't give up. Other times they'd feel, well, I haven't got far enough, and they'd leave it to someone on the next shift.
A fresh pair of eyes.
Yeah, quite.
To look at Built Up, we have to remember, of course, that no one person here should be, you know, sort of put head and shoulders above the rest, really. There was such a machine, if you like, operating, of each cog being their own kind of genius at that level of the organisation. But he is worth celebrating, isn't he?
Oh, very much so. I mean, he himself was very modest about it, saying that he just happened to be there at the time and that he fell back on what he'd been trained to do. And he didn't make a big deal of it, if you like. But the department as a whole, the research department, had been sitting there staring at this code string for 2 months at that point, and no one had got anywhere with it. And it was given to him, I think, as the phrase was, as a last resort, as a measure of desperation. They went, well, give it to the new guy, see what he can make of it.
We've got to find him
and
something
so
to do. Yeah.
You do need to have the right people in the right place to have those flashes of genius and inspiration. And he was one of those people.
Time seems to have flown, so with the few seconds left, I'll say that this has been the RCAF show with the RCAF Streamliners, Gloria Brent, Corporal Dave Davies, Sergeant Ted Hockridge, and the Twin Piano Team, Corporal Neil Chotem and Sergeant Ken Bray. Our guest comedian was Cyril Fletcher. We hope to be with you again soon. Until then, this is Flying Officer Ken Mayer speaking for all Canadians over here and wishing you all good luck, good hunting, and Godspeed over there.
We did say at the beginning of this that it wasn't all doom and gloom. Now, we've talked about Bill Tutton, the highs of the breakthroughs with Lorenz. That seems to be the only high that we've touched upon. But this was a point in the war when things were really turning a corner here. It was no longer a little cottage industry of people like Bill Tutton, you know, straight out of Cambridge, a few Tweedy people sitting with pencils and paper. It was really turning into a factory, and there were big things ahead, weren't there?
Absolutely. I mean, this block A opens. Other blocks were already under construction. We like to talk about the industrial phase of Bletchley Park, the idea that it became a factory for intelligence later in the war. And you're at that point in 1942 where the gates of the factory are opening for the first time and lots of new workers are being hired, and they will settle down to producing enormous quantities of intelligence on an industrial scale. The only question in their minds is how long they're going to have to do it for. But they are ready to go on for as long as it takes at this point.
As we here at home contemplate our own duties, our own responsibilities, let us think and think hard of the example which is being set for us by our fighting men. Our soldiers and sailors are members of well-disciplined units, but they're still and forever individuals, free individuals. They're farmers and workers, businessmen, professional men, artists, clerks. They are the United States of America. That is why they fight. We too are the United States of America. That is why we must work and sacrifice. It is for them. It is for us. It is for victory.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.